This is Arts Alive for this Saturday, April 9th. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Today, if you climb the hill to the Skirball Center, you can also take the mound.
We don't normally encourage visitors to throw things in our exhibitions, but we figured, you know, let's try something new.
Kate Thurston is an assistant curator at the Skirball Cultural Center. In a moment, she walks us through their exhibit, Chasing Dreams, Baseball and Becoming American, which comes complete with a pitcher's mound you can try out for yourself. Perfect for this opening week of the season. Also on the program today, Opera Santa Barbara will close the season with a Puccini double bill, and when they open next season, they're bringing the kids. We'll explain in a bit. And on Ask the Dean today, what makes film scores so recognizable? That's the question for Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music. But first, here's Alan Chapman with the Arts News.
From the Arts Desk today, a rare appointment at the LA Phil. This week, Finnish conductor Susanna Malki joined the short list of people named principal guest conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and it's a very short list. The Phil's only other principal guest conductors were Sir Simon Rattle and Michael Tilson Thomas. Malki starts her three-year appointment during the Phil's 2017-2018 season. She previously conducted the orchestra in their production of the multimedia opera Alice in Wonderland last spring. Malki is also chief conductor of the Helsinki Philharmonic. KUSC's Gail Eichenthal spoke with LA Phil President and CEO Deborah Borda about the appointment.
Gustavo and I just felt that not that the time had come, but that the right person had come, the right artist, the right musician. Susanna had a special kind of chemistry with the orchestra, different from the chemistry that Gustavo has, but undeniable, that special combustion that happens. And her DNA fits with our DNA. She shares interests. She shares a vision. And when I announced it to the orchestra the other day, great cheer went up. Now, there's been a lot of commentary which has come up about her being a woman. And, you know, it really doesn't have anything to do with that. I think between all of the extraordinarily gifted young female conductors, and I don't even like to say that, this is going to be less and less of an issue. And this is an appointment that has to do with her as an artist. And it was just right for the LA Phil and right for Susanna.
One still stumbles on surprisingly sexist comments from certain males in the world of the orchestra, including recently a conductor himself who said he doesn't believe that women should be conducting. What about in the roster of the LA Philharmonic? Are there still male musicians who have issues with female conductors, or is that a thing of the past?
Yeah, Yuri Temirkanov famously went on record just recently saying he doesn't believe that a woman can conduct. The people who hold that sort of viewpoint are of a certain age group. And frankly, to the musicians of the LA Phil today, I think it's about as interesting to them, whether it is a woman conductor or a male conductor, as whether she or he is left-handed or right-handed. It is simply not a stir. It's not a question. And of course, our orchestra now is about 50% gender balanced. It's 50-50.
You described chemistry with the orchestra. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Chemistry with the orchestra actually falls into two different areas. First is the part where of preparation. How does the conductor work with the orchestra? And for example, Susanna worked on she's done a lot of central repertoire with us, but she worked on a very difficult piece, which was staging of the full opera, Alice in Wonderland by Eun-Suk Chin. And to see the precision that she brought to the rehearsal, her ability to not just inspire the musicians, but to help them, to guide them through a difficult piece. That's one part of it. But then the next part, and this is harder to describe as, but we saw this also in her more central repertoire concerts and again in the Alice, is when the moment comes to make music, can they make magic on the stage? Is it a good marriage with the orchestra? Now, how do we know they're making magic on the stage? Well, you sit in the audience and you can tell. I don't know why, but you know that when you're in a great performance, the audience knows it.
LA Phil President and CEO Deborah Borda talking about Susanna Malki, the newly named principal guest conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Borda spoke with KUSC's Gail Eichenthal. That's the Arts News for Saturday, April 9th. On this date in 1939, American contralto Marian Anderson sang for a crowd of more than 75,000 at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. The public concert was organized after the Daughters of the American Revolution refused Anderson permission to sing to an integrated audience in their Constitution Hall. The DAR's stance prompted First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt to resign from the organization, saying in a letter, "You had an opportunity to lead in an enlightened way, and it seems to me that your organization has failed." For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Journalist George Will once wrote, "Baseball, it is said, is only a game. True, and the Grand Canyon is only a hole." The history of America's favorite pastime is inextricably linked with the history of the country itself. Chasing Dreams, Baseball and Becoming American, and The Unauthorized History of Baseball in 100 Odd Paintings are two new exhibits at the Skirball Cultural Center that explore how Americanism and baseball have interacted over time. KUSC's Gail Eichenthal walked through the shows with assistant curator Kate Thurston.
Both exhibitions are looking at baseball, and Chasing Dreams is looking at the way baseball has been a tool different ethnic and minority groups to both become American, to feel at home in America, while also preserving their identities. It is a history show, so it is a show that utilizes historic artifacts, memorabilia, whereas The Unauthorized History of Baseball, The Art of Ben Sakaguchi, is an art show. So you're dealing with baseball, but you're exploring it in two very different ways. And Ben is exploring it in a very whimsical and yet pointed way. Ben has a point of view, and that comes through in his art. He's highlighting overlooked stories, people's stories, and he does it in this very colorful California medium using orange crate labels.
Fascinating that he stuck to the same format for all of this art over a period of going on 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So starting back in the mid-1990s. So they're kind of like mock orange crate labels with,
yes,
with some fictitious brand names.
Yes. The second export out of California in the early 20th century was oranges, behind oil. The oil boom built Los Angeles, and oranges built the Southland. And orange crate labels were used to market that. And they usually played on a lot of California's fictional fantasy Spanish past, sort of ideas of Mediterranean, that sort of thing. And so he's using that medium that was ubiquitous throughout grocery stores and homes, and he's taking it in a totally new direction. He's reclaiming it to tell these really interesting stories. And he loves these orange crate labels. You know, as a little boy in San Bernardino, he didn't go to museums. He didn't have a lot of art in his life. And this was the first really colorful art he saw. So he's really embracing it and doing something very, very different with it.
And he saw it as part of the family business, I understand.
Yes. His father was a grocer. Hideo Sakaguchi emigrated here as a young man. He didn't speak any English when he came here, and he loved baseball. Ben is not a baseball fan. This is really an interest that spawns from his love of his father. They are vivid, right? These are not soft watercolors. These are larger-than-life, leaping-off-the-canvas colors.
I think it's really interesting that in both exhibits you have people who are exploring both the beauty and inspiration of baseball, but also some of the darker chapters in its history.
Yeah, I think with all romantic ideas, there is the darkness and the light. And baseball as a sport and baseball as a symbol for America certainly fully reflects that. The originators of the show, the National Museum of American Jewish History, did a fabulous job of really exploring the unpleasant stories in baseball. And it's something that we thought was vital to carry forward in our stories that we were adding.
Let's look at what you described yourself as a very painful part of the exhibit.
Sure. We look at baseball as a battleground for identity, and it's a theme that comes up with different groups. Again and again, we certainly look at that with the African-American experience through players like Jackie Robinson and Doc Ellis, Hank Aaron, a Afro-Latin player, Roberto Clemente. We really want to explore the idea of what it means to be an American. You know, the definition of nationalism is not who you imagine yourself to be, but who you imagine that you aren't. And so baseball is a way that we have broadened that idea of nationalism to include more people into America. So here in this case, we're looking at a couple different pieces, and I'm going to call your attention to two. So the first is a ticket from the 1919 World Series, a moment in baseball that has been reviled, right? The throwing of a series, the ruining of careers, shoeless Joe Jackson famously never played ball again. The reason the ticket is used in this case about anti-Semitism is because it was thrown by a Jewish gangster. And so it was seen as, you know, Jewish people were behind the scenes in a shadowy way ruining America's game. And here we have a book produced by Henry Ford, and he said, if fans want to know the trouble with American baseball, they have it in three words, quote, too much Jew. So this theme of backlash from immigration is something that this case deals with head on here.
We're standing in front of a showcase of sort of Sandy Koufax-zabilia.
Yes. We have a lot of pieces of ephemera belonging to Sandy Koufax. So we explore the impact of him as a baseball superstar and celebrity, but it also weaves back to what he represented as an American. And so here we have Sandy Koufax, U.S. Army Reserve meal card. Like Hank Greenberg, both were involved with the United States military. Both were very, very talented athletes, and both did not play in Yom Kippur. So we see baseball move from the early 20th century, where ball players who were Jewish felt the need to change their name, to a point where being Jewish was something you could be proud of, fully a part of America.
And in the early 60s, it was a big deal when the best pitcher in baseball chose not to pitch a World Series game during the high holidays.
Yes, it was incredibly important. And it shouldn't be ignored that that's a risky thing to do. That has the potential to alienate fans who are not Jewish, right? Because they're angry that you're not participating in the World Series. But the effect was just the opposite. It further endeared Sandy Koufax to the Los Angeles community and to the Jewish community.
So fledgling Sandy Koufaxes out there will get a chance to show off their style in what is actually a pitching mound in the museum.
Yes, we don't normally encourage visitors to throw things in our exhibitions, but we figured, you know, let's try something new. And so you'll get to try and pitch like Sandy Koufax. It's a fun activity, but it also delves into a little bit of the mathematics over here. You can explore how physically this action happens and get a flavor for his style.
Kate Thurston is an assistant curator at the Skirball Cultural Center. The style and significance of Sandy Koufax is part of the exhibition Chasing Dreams, Baseball and Becoming American, the companion exhibit featuring that unique take on orange crate labels is The Unauthorized History of Baseball in 100 Odd Paintings, the art of Ben Sakaguchi. Both are on view through the fall. Visit skirball.org for more. And thanks to KUSC's Gail Eichenthal for bringing us that story. You're listening to Arts Alive here on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Next week, we pay tribute to composer Stephen Stuckey. He had deep roots in Los Angeles, and we mark his passing by exploring his art and legacy with some of the people who knew him well. That's next Saturday at 8 a.m., or listen to past episodes of Arts Alive anytime at the podcast page. Visit kusc.org/artsalive. Coming up, Laugh and Cry with Puccini in Santa Barbara. But here, once again, is Alan Chapman right now with this week's Around Town Arts Calendar.
Here's a bit of what's happening around town, starting as we always do with a free event. The West Los Angeles Symphony gives a high-octane concert tomorrow at Royce Hall at UCLA. Benjamin Wallfisch is the conductor, and the symphony is joined by the young award-winning violinist William Hagen for the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. Also on the program, the intermezzo from Mascagni's Cavalleria Rusticana and Haydn's London Symphony. That's the West Los Angeles Symphony performing tomorrow at 7 p.m. at UCLA's Royce Hall. Admission is free. You can find details at WLASymphony.com. Tomorrow afternoon in the desert, the 18th annual Opera in the Park concert. The Palm Springs Opera Guild presents 8 young opera professionals singing favorite arias at Sunrise Park in Palm Springs. Bring a blanket, bring a picnic. Opera in the Park tomorrow from 1 to 4 p.m. and admission is free. Information at palmspringsoperaguild.org. And tonight, Sharon Lavery of the USC Thornton School of Music conducts the Downey Symphony Orchestra at Downey Civic Theater. The program includes 2 works by Thornton alum Oscar Navarro, his Downey Overture, dedicated to the orchestra, and his second clarinet concerto. Also on the program, Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. The Downey Symphony Orchestra tonight at 8 p.m. at Downey Civic Theater. And for tickets, you can go to downeysymphony.org. That's a bit of what's happening around town this week. For details on these and other cultural events in Southern California, visit performingartslive.com. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
Coming up on Ask the Dean, how music makes movies come alive. But first, this month, Opera Santa Barbara will close out its season with the Puccini double bill, the comedy Gianni Schicchi, and the much more serious Suor Angelica. The productions will mark the end of artistic director Kostis Protopapas' first season with the company. The Athens-born conductor is just the 4th artistic director in the company's 21-year history. Protopapas told KUSC's Gail Eichenthal that he learned piano as a child and as a teenager worked on variety shows. As a young man, he moved to the U.S. to pursue music, but it was at a conducting workshop in the Czech Republic that he became smitten with opera.
And I really fell in love with it. It brought a lot of things together for me. Of course, the richness of the history and all the topics that opera explores, that to me, that really spoke to me, in addition to like having such a large family of artists.
Yeah, you must have had a flair for languages because you're a young Greek man coming to Czechoslovakia.
English was the main language to conduct business, but eventually my working knowledge of Czech helped me a lot when I did Janáček's The Kind of Little Vixen for the first time in 2002, which is one of the operas that we're doing here next year.
Such a gorgeous piece. I can't wait to hear it and talk a little more about it. Let's look at the final operas of this season, Puccini's great one acts, Suor Angelica and Gianni Schicchi. One is kind of a searing tragedy and the other is a family farce, a very dramatic juxtaposition.
Absolutely. This double bill of Suor Angelica and Gianni Schicchi is very, very frequently performed because these are 2 short but perfect operas. I do think that in some ways, Gianni Schicchi is perhaps his most perfect opera, that, inspired by a story in Dante's Inferno. That is a story about greedy relatives who are trying to push each other out of the inheritance of their rich uncle. His understanding of comedy is uncanny. Of course, some of his great tunes, probably his most famous aria, O mio bambino caro, is from Gianni Schicchi. And there's a lot of discussion about the creation of the new middle class, and Gianni Schicchi, the title character, represents that ascendant middle class, the really smart, can-do, forward-looking man, as opposed to the relatives that are fighting over their inheritance, that are sort of the old aristocracy. And so the story is about how Gianni Schicchi outwits them. And the other, Suor Angelica, is very moving. It's a very sad story. And that's also, in a way, a little bit topical, because it's a story about a girl who, at a very young age, became a single mother in a society where that was not acceptable. Her family would have none of that. So they forced her to become a nun. They took the child away, and she never saw it again. This story takes place in a convent. The opera ends with a miracle. The young woman, the young nun, dies, and she has a vision of her son. Puccini prepares you for that. The way he sets the scene of the convent and the innocence and the sort of wide-eyedness, if you will, of some of the younger nuns and their relationships with the abbess and all that. It's sort of a look in a very intimate community, but it's also a very topical story because children of being born to unwedded mothers, it's even in our time and in our society sometimes, it's a very difficult topic.
Yes, in a very short period of time, he grabs you emotionally to such an extent that if I had to make a guess in which opera more tears were shed by the audience, this might be it, even this one-act opera.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, it is really a tour de force by Puccini that he manages to pack all his best stuff in these really short pieces. It's just only a true master can create a miniature that has that level of detail and that level of perfection.
Let's look ahead to next season. You have a beautifully balanced presentation of Carmen by Bizet, Janáček's Cunning Little Vixen, and Puccini's La Rondine.
It always strikes me how multifaceted an art form opera is and how many different ways it has to speak to and about the human experience. Every opera tells a different story. In programming a season, I think it's important to try to cover as much ground as possible, even with just three operas. So we open with Carmen, which is one of the most beloved operas. It's going to be a traditional grand production. It's just obviously a story of passion, jealousy, and all those things that people like to watch in the show. Then The Cunning Little Vixen is one of my favorite operas. It is a humorous and tender allegory about the cycle of life, about man and nature. And it's very funny at times. It's very moving. Basically, humans and animals bump into one another in the forest outside the small Czech village. So his characters are really very accessible to all of us. So we are doing this in English. It's one of those stories that adults understand on a certain level, and children understand on a different level. So it'd be a great outing.
You also have a little children's chorus. Tell us about plans for how that will work.
As it happened, two out of our three main stage operas call for children's chorus. Carmen has a children's chorus and The Cunning Little Vixen. In thinking about how to address that need, we realized that there's currently no established children's chorus in Santa Barbara. So we decided that we're going to create a children's chorus that will be here to stay and something that will hopefully blossom and will spread love for singing to as many children as possible in the Santa Barbara area. So we are going to have some auditions later this spring and early summer, and we're going to recruit a number of children. Not only will they be involved in Carmen and The Cunning Little Vixen, but will stay engaged throughout the season. We'll have some concerts, hopefully during the holiday time. They will receive some training in, you know, music, reading, theory, vocal technique. And we are also planning on giving them their own production after outside of our main stage season. We're hoping to do a production of Hans Krause's Brundibar, which was an opera that was written in Terezin in the concentration camp and was performed there by the children. It's a very, very moving experience. Every time I've seen this opera, it just has a tremendous message of humanity.
You've worked at many of the major companies in the U.S., Chicago Lyric, L.A. Opera, Tulsa Opera, where you've been for nearly 15 years. Isn't it rather extraordinary that a small city like Santa Barbara supports an opera company?
Not only the opera company, but the concentration of high-quality classical arts in this small town is just amazing. You can probably see as many great orchestras and great performers here as you can in Chicago. So it is really an amazing community for the arts, and it's a privilege to be serving that community.
Well, we're lucky to have you here, and good luck on next season, and toy, toy, toy on the final Puccinis.
Thank you very much.
Kostis Protopapas is artistic director at Opera Santa Barbara. Their Puccini double bill opens April 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Granada Theater. There's a second performance there on the 24th at 2:30 p.m. Visit operasb.org for tickets. And Protopapas spoke with KUSC's Gail Eichenthal.
And now here's Gail Eichenthal once again, this time with a musical Movie Mystery for Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music.
Welcome, Dean Robb. Great to have you, as always.
Thank you, Gail. It's always great to be here.
And it's always wonderful to field a question from one of our most devoted listeners, Gerard.
Absolutely.
Wonders what it is that makes film scores so easily recognizable as such. And Gerard suspects it has something to do with the shifts in themes and moods that fit a particular movie.
Mm-hmm. That's a very perceptive question of Gerard. I went to several members of our film scoring faculty, and really we sat around and talked about this over coffee. It was very, I don't want to say easy answer, but everyone agreed. They understood the question, and they agreed why it was. That's what film music is. It's written to be this way. It's written to be recognizable. The film music actually has a very important function. So when they're picking a melody, they want something that you're going to recognize the next time it comes back, for example. That when you hear this melody the first time, when you hear it the second time, you know that it's either for a character or for a mood or something. It's going to help the storyline.
Darth Vader's coming back.
Absolutely. And if you have to hear it 10 times before you know that, it is not successful film music. It's got to be such recognizable and distinctive melodies that you're going to recognize it right away as that. Interestingly, the melodies also have to be deconstructible, if that's a word, because, for example, you may have a place in a movie where you don't have time for the whole melody. You only have time for two or three notes of it, and you still want to be able to play those two or three notes and have it recognizable as, oh, this is whatever it is that's going on, whether it's, again, the mood, the character, the situation. So melodies are constructed that way within film music. But it goes way beyond the melodies as well. Same thing with harmonies. There's certain harmonies that you might only have 2 or 3 seconds to do something, but sometimes the harmony or the orchestration is so distinctive and so clear. Think of that opening chord, for example, in Star Wars, which has all the fourths in it. It's both how it's orchestrated and it's also the notes in there. That you hear that, you know instantly what it is. You know that within a split second, and what's supposed to evoke in you, this feeling of triumph. So you hear film music and you know that instantly because that's how it's written. That's a skill and that's an art in itself, to be able to write things that are so quickly and so beautifully, yet without making them simplistic. That's extremely hard to do. And that's a different skill, I think, than writing concert music, which is one of the reasons why you don't see so many composers who really cross that. You know, the great film composers are great film composers. There's very few people who actually are able. There are some, of course, but very few who make that transition, because these are fundamentally different ways of constructing the music because of the goal. You're looking for more subtlety in concert music. You have a little more leisure to, over the next 40 minutes of a symphony or something, to actually work and get into depth and everything. But you don't have that luxury in a film score at all. So the simple answer is it's written that way. It's written to be immediately recognizable, to evoke things. So you know instantly when something's a piece of film music.
And it evokes emotion, certainly.
Oh, sure.
And these days, there's also some interesting trends. I think of The Revenant and an article in the LA Times about how the score was not eligible for the Academy Award because not only did they use 3 different composers, but there were pre-recorded tracks of some of their earlier works. There was some classical music thrown in. This is an incredibly intricate layering, a soundscape, really, for The Revenant.
It is.
And I know sound and music are terribly important to the director, Alejandro Iñárritu, who grew up with classical music. It's not what you're talking about. It's not necessarily a theme that you're going to hum on the way outside the theater.
Right. But you'd still recognize it because of the timbres, because of how it's structured. But, you know, that's part of a bigger conversation. What's happening there is what's happening in all music, as the genres are really colliding and being put together. So it doesn't even fit the category. I think that speaks volumes. Is the category wrong, or is music just changing that quickly? Obviously, it's a very successful score. It just, we have to redefine everything we do. But the same principles. It's got to be immediate, and you're going to know instantly that is the music from The Revenant.
Do you have a question for Dean Rob Kudieta and his team of experts? Send an email to askthedean@kusc.org. Again, that's askthedean@kusc.org. You can also submit a question on Twitter. We're at @ClassicalKUSC and just use the hashtag KUSCAskTheDean. And that wraps up this edition of Arts Alive for this Saturday, the 9th of April. The technical director is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had lots of help this week from KUSC's Gail Eichenthal and also from Alan Chapman. Thanks as well to Sheila Tepper. I'm Brian Lawrence, and have a great weekend.